So I'm going to talk about the recruitment and retention of Latina immigrants to a randomized clinical trial that we had in the Birmingham, Alabama area. Dr. Isabel Scrinci is actually the PI on this project, so for those of you who have come to APHA in the past, you may have heard her speak about related research. I'm sure that after, I don't know how many talks we've had now, like four, that you've gotten the sense of the background. So we all understand the urgency of understanding, you know, what this population is about and how we need to address the nuances that make them different from U.S.-born Latinos and also other populations in the U.S. So there's a growing scientific interest, a federal requirement that funded science address these particular populations, and our ability really to make progress in understanding health disparities is thwarted by the fact that we don't fully understand, you know, the healthcare needs of this population. So the overall objective of this particular project was to reduce cervical cancer incidence among a sample of Latina immigrants that were living in Birmingham, Alabama, through the reduction of HPV and increasing pap testing. In the past, there have been interventions that have improved health behaviors in Latinas through interventions that focused on cultural beliefs, attitudes, behaviors, as well as the involvement of lay health educators. So our proposal, and this is verbatim from Dr. Scrinci, in this study, a combination of these approaches was used to develop and implement and evaluate the efficacy of a theory-based and culturally relevant intervention, focusing on primary and secondary prevention of cervical cancer. And the proposed number was 416 Latina immigrants through a 5-year group randomized control trial. So Friendship Circles for Health began, and for those of you who do community work, you know that it's a very exciting thing to be able to be on the brink of a project like this. But for those of you who do it, you also know that this is when the madness begins. So I actually was the program manager for this program, and have been with, so the program began a year before I came on, and we were able to recruit 559 Latina immigrants. So, you know, we had proposed 416, 559 were recruited, of which 4 qualitative interviews, remember this is a cognitive behavioral intervention, 11 of those were pilot, and then we have 542 that were consented and enrolled. Now, in that, you know, mayhem, we had one who consented but was not pre-tested. So actually, this particular person, you know, when you're in the trailer parks or wherever it is that you're recruiting the women, these participants have to make a decision on the spot. And so in this particular case, we had consented her. Her husband came in the room and she said, you know, we're not sure, we may be moving, I don't think I want to go through with this. She ended up not pre-testing, however she had been consented, so we do count her in our numbers. Friendship Circles was held in homes, in people's homes, so if you ask me, I know every trailer park in the Birmingham area, and all of the apartment buildings and neighborhoods where these participants come from. It's a cognitive behavioral intervention, built with input from a target audience, that we did do those qualitative interviews and that pilot study in order to be able to you know, effectively create these qualitative and quantitative assessments, develop the intervention that was targeted at the population we were aiming at, and then pilot tested as well. In terms of recruitment strategies, we canvassed. So if you come into our suite, into our offices, we have like a wall's worth of a map of Jefferson and Shelby counties, which are like the big counties in the Birmingham area, and little flags with all of the places where we aim to recruit. We went door to door. We were there at 7 in the morning, or we were there at 9 p.m. You know, whenever the women were there, that's when we were at their doors looking to talk to them. We initially thought we would bring them in or hook them, if you will, with a talk that was unrelated to what we were actually going to be doing. Something that was of general interest to everybody. So this is, again, a randomized controlled trial. So we were randomizing to a cervical cancer intervention. And actually, this was a dual randomized controlled trial where the control group was actually nutrition-based. So they each served as each other's control. So the general topic was how to raise your children in the U.S., cómo educar a nuestros niños en este país. And it worked, but we found in the end that it was unnecessary. So it you know, we did it maybe for the first six groups, maybe eight groups out of, what do we have, 27 groups, something like that. And then eventually just went straight into screening and enrolling and so forth. So we would screen, we had a screener that the interviewers or educators would take with them so that we knew immediately, was this person gonna qualify for a study or not. They were randomized, like I said, either to the cervical cancer or the nutrition arm. We had baseline questionnaires, and then we had information on recruitment and enrollment. With regards to our retention strategies, we had four lay health educators that were a part of this study. They were paid, so they were staff with our research group. So they each, based on the group that they had, made monthly phone calls. We had quarterly meriendas or potlucks. So this was a largely Mexican immigrant population, and I'm Mexican and I love to eat, so we were like, well, everybody must love to eat, so this was a great way to get everybody together and, you know, use it as a retention strategy. We had quarterly newsletters. We sent them birthday cards, get well cards. You know, you get to know this population very intimately, or these participants. And so you want to make sure that you know that you're there for them, for the things that are happening in their lives. And then the lay health educators had a database with detailed notes about each participant. So for each of the sessions, they would go in and say, so-and-so came to the session. Or it would have a little thing on the side that would, it would be like a memory jogger. Maria Garcia has three kids. Her husband works at the bakery. You know, so that when she would call, oh, so how's your husband? Oh, how's, you know, Juancito? And it helps because, you know, at the end of the day, you have 500 participants. You're good. You're bound to forget some of the details. So these are examples of our newsletters. So each quarter, we would send the cervical cancer participants a newsletter within the main article being cervical cancer based or something related, but it was information about cervical cancer. And then the nutrition group would have like mainly nutrition information and then like a flu article or and I think another one was like poison in children, so how to keep all your meds safe and making sure all of your cleaning supplies were put away and stuff like that. For the nutrition group, we had recetas saludables, which are healthy recipes, and we had one of our nutrition educators come up with recipes every quarter so that they would have something, you know, fun and tasty to eat. These are examples of our retention cards. So, you know, basic PDFs. We had something very general created because it's federally funded. We could not send Christmas cards or, you know, more religious-based cards. So we stuck with the more general stuff. Okay, so we screened 726 women. It's actually more like in the 900s, I think. We really screened quite a significant number of women. Those that consented in the cervical cancer group were 283. In the nutrition group, 259. It was an eight-week intervention, so there were six group sessions and two individual sessions where the educator would one-on-one sit with the participant in their cervical cancer case, say, you know, if you want to call and we can set up your appointment for your pap test, we can do that. Or if you want to talk about your blue form, you know, so that they could get care at the local hospital for preventive services or whatever it may be, then they would help them with anything that they needed like that. So at the end of the 8 weeks, we had, you know, 30-some women drop out, and in the nutrition group about the same. After 12 months, so this is a two-year follow-up total. So the women are followed up for 2 years. So far, we only have the data for 12 months because we are in process for completing our two-year follow-up. We have just a few more groups that are pending. So we ended up with 223 that completed the follow-up assessment in the cervical cancer group and 210 in the nutrition, which are still significantly large numbers. So retention at 8 weeks overall was 86%. At 12 months is 80%. So we're really proud of these percentages. I think that if any of the lay health educators were here, you would see the excitement in them because this project is due to their hard work, sweat, and tears. Because really, these women were out there when it was pouring rain at 9 o'clock at night. Alabama doesn't get snow really. But we get pretty frigid, cold days. And so, they were out there. They were out there doing the sessions, making sure that they were engaging these women. So this is really due to their hard work. And I played a little role too. So out of those that attended the first session, because this was a big thing too, we wanted to know, we had some dropout between those that enrolled and pre-tested and then when the sessions actually began. So we wanted to know the retention rates there. So for out of those who attended the first session, which I believe were like 506 women, at 8 weeks we had 92.6% retention, and then at 12 months, 83.6. So still very, very good numbers. So our study sample, again, out of 726 Latina immigrants, 543 were eligible and agreed to participate, minus that one that didn't pretest. Of those 506 attended the first session, we had a mean age of 30.7 years. So, relatively young population. Time in the U.S., 84.4 months. For those of you who do quick math, okay, so we had this population, we have some that had been in Birmingham or in the U.S. like 15, 20 years. It was a very small proportion of women who had been. And then we had as few as 6 months. There's a pretty significant range. Fairly well educated, about 9 years of education. Most were married, 93.7%. Most were homemakers, and large proportion of the population were uninsured. So retention comparisons. We used t-tests and chi-square tests to assess the differences between those women who were retained and not retained at 8 weeks. Those who were not retained had been in the U.S. less time, were more likely to be unemployed and uninsured. At 12 months, about the same. The only difference is that instead of being unemployed, we saw that the population or the women who were not retained had lower income. And this is actually very consistent with what we saw in person. So the women who were dropping out were saying, this again, like with our male speaker, I forget his name, but he was talking about his project starting at the brink of the economic downturn. So similarly here, we're looking at baseline here about, 3 years ago or so? So this is when people started to lose their jobs. Even in Alabama, construction started to go down, which was the large source of employment for our husbands of this population. And so the women had to find work. And so they were saying, we can't come to your sessions because I need to work. Well, what do you say? No, go work, come to our session. it's very consistent with what we saw in the community. So challenges, successes, and lessons learned. Challenges. The first year, I'm not going to lie, I wasn't there, but I've been told we went through 4 managers. We were trying to have a set of 4 lay health educators. We went through a slew of those. Not everyone is meant for community work. It's hard work to be out there. And so it was very tough to retain lay health educators. The training of lay health individuals in cognitive behavioral training also posed somewhat of a challenge. So they went through a 3-month training session where all they did was learn about these theories. They were tested. We mocked sessions. So I pretended to be a participant, and we went through the questionnaires, and we went through teaching them about partner communication and things like that. So, I mean, it was very intensive. With regards to recruitment, the women were very suspicious. We gave them cash when we pre-tested them and also when we post-tested. And so they didn't quite understand why we were giving them money. They said, well, if this is so great for me, why are you paying me to do it, right? Mobility. So again, you know, we would have individuals in our study who, within the first 8 weeks of the sessions, had moved once at least. Within the first 12 months of the intervention, had moved three different times from one apartment, or they had sold a trailer park home and had moved to a different trailer park. So, very mobile. The weather was an issue, and the economic situation. Our successes. So we bought the lay health educators, and I had one as well, and all of the interviewers. So we had interviewers as well that would go and do the pretests and post-tests and follow-up assessments. UAB t-shirts to identify with the university. We had a very persistent and creative staff. So, I mean, they're really on these participants to make sure they're still there. They call themselves the FBI because they will show up at wherever they work, the laundromat, whatever. I mean, they're there. Hey, remember me? Oh, yeah, I was going to call you today. And then, you know. So babysitting. So we offered babysitting because that was the only way that we would get the women to go to the sessions. And then a case management approach. So, you know, you're dealing with each participant on a case-by-case basis. I'm running out of time. So in terms of lessons learned, be present in the community. You understand who you're working with. Advocate for that community. You cannot work with a community and not be an advocate for them. Get to know who your target audience is. For those of you who are PIs, keep your NIH program director informed. So this is one of the biggest recommendations that our PI always says. Let them know you're having difficulties, you know, and what those difficulties are. Build a research team who cares about the participants. You really need people who care about the work that they're doing. And be persistent. Of course, you know, this shows that these RCTs are feasible in this community, and that, you know, there are going to be issues that are going to come across. And on my way here, I opened a fortune cookie, and it said, a conclusion is simply the place where you got tired of thinking. So I thought, well, how appropriate. So let's keep thinking. Acknowledgements to everyone who has been a part, and I probably left people out, but, you know, this is like many of the people who were consistent in terms of being lay health educators. These are the four that stuck with us. The interviewers, we have quite a few that went through, graduate students, a research colleague that has, like, really helped, a former program manager, the two investigators, Isabel Scorinci for the cervical cancer, Andrea Sherrington for the nutrition, and then thanks to my fellowship grant for funding me to come here.
My question is for Tara Truman. Uh-huh. Yes, it's about your intervention. I was wondering, when you went to the homes of the families, mm-hmm. did you have the promotoras have a checklist of things that they had to cover each time so that it was similar between interventions, even when it went off topic?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They followed a... we have a set program where it has, like, it's an instruction manual of exactly what the program is. And so they have to, each session, so they have four times that they go, there's different sections of what they need to follow. So say the first is about diabetes, what insulin is, all of those things. They had to cover those things. Since it was 2 to 3 hours, there was flexibility in that time frame where they were able to address other issues if they needed to. But yeah, they definitely followed our guidelines with that, yeah.
Question in the back? My question is for Inspecta.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to your promotoras or lay health workers who took care, were they in charge of the same participants all the time, or did participants switch between the four?
No. Well, so when we had lay health educators that left, they would take over the participants. But since then, the group that they began with is whom they have followed up with the entire time. So they have been consistent throughout.
Okay.
At the same program, I'm interested in your behavioral outcomes. You mentioned primary and secondary. So
yes.
Screening is one, but I'm interested, especially because they're married, what the behavioral outcomes are.
So it's very interesting. We encountered some resistance from the husbands initially. Whether it be that they were unused to having their wives do something outside of their normal routines, whether it be in the home or go straight to and from work. But I think that because our staff was so engaging, we really included the husband and often would even go to the extent of asking their permission, because sometimes that's all it really takes is making someone feel like they're part of the decision-making process. And so so we did do that. There is a component of the intervention that dealt with partner communication, okay? And so, it's really interesting because we go through mock scenarios in the sessions. And it's, you're doing the dishes and your husband comes behind you and he's really loving and you're mad because you've conjured in your mind all the things that are wrong with your marriage, and he came home late, so you think he's out cheating, and how to deal with that, and how to talk to your partner about that, and how to talk to your partner about even things like sex and what feels good, and have you had partners in the past, and have you had sexually transmitted infections, and so that's all part of it. We haven't analyzed necessarily the data for that, but that's upcoming.
Please.
Yeah, another question for Britt. I've noticed the insurance coverage, it was 90-some percent were uninsured. So did you identify a place where you could go to get the pap smear?
Yes, ma'am. So we are big believers in, if you are going to teach about something, then you have to provide the means for them to do it. And so the health department was one of the places that a lot of these women would go and get pap testing. There's this other place called Birmingham Healthcare where pap testing is either free or offered at a very reduced cost. Also, each year, RPI hosts breast and cervical cancer events where they make agreements with the local hospitals to provide pap testing either free or for $25 depending on an income level range, and then also mammograms, which is not part of this intervention, but part of that as well.
There's a question in the front.
No. The second lady, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, with the white outfit.
Hi.
It seems like, are you thinking of incorporating some information about emotional health in your program? It seems like that would be kind of easy to do without kind of identifying it as...
It's already there.
Oh,
so
okay.
Both the intervention and the control group, there were signs and symptoms of stress and depression, as well as quite a bit of information about depression during and after pregnancy and strategies for management. It's just that both groups got that. So it's in the curriculum. It wasn't the primary aim. It was there. What we didn't do is have any kind of further, anything more in-depth in terms of people who had high depressive symptoms.
So
we
you're basically trying to communicate that emotional health is as
very
important as physical health.
Absolutely. It was there throughout. Right.
Did you have another
question? Yeah, sorry, this question is for Tara. Mm-hmm. For your four-week sessions, was there some sort of evaluation or activity that tested knowledge at the end of each session, aside from the pre and post-test?
Not for this program, we didn't. We did, our other programs that we've done that, where it was like a short 5 or 6 question about specifically what you learned in this class. But for the diabetes program, we didn't. We did a pre-test at the beginning and at the end. They had different things, like the first session, they did like risk assessments. They had a lot of paperwork to fill out, and we did risk assessments the first day. So we try to limit sometimes a lot of the paperwork so that we can focus on the education part. So this one is just pre and post, yeah.
Brett, I have a couple of questions. One was first for those who talked about working in private homes where we had interventions happening. What kind of, were there any challenges associated with that? And also just your average size of your groups. And then I also wanted to ask about text messaging youth surveys, because that was very intriguing.
Dr. Garcia, do you want to go from text messaging?
Yeah, I think we can talk about it. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And in the literature, you see that people have used handheld palms where the data are just collected and not immediately uploaded. Now people are getting into using phones, and they'll either reimburse the SIM card or they'll provide a new phone, because teens already have phones, the percent, the rates are super high. So for some youth, it's just easier to reimburse. But we can talk more about it. There's a good movement. There's less use of text messaging for actually evaluating an intervention. There's a lot more of it to deliver an intervention. And so what I'm saying is we really need to move it into being an actual source of data to evaluate the outcomes of our interventions as well.
Let me share one thing. Actually, this week, today is the first day of the mHealth Summit, and they're webcasting their plenary, so if anyone's interested in technology, mHealth. So. And the question regarding working in the home, the challenges from anyone.
Well, our groups, we had about between 5 and 10 in each group. And we tried to keep it smaller because we wanted to really, you know, be able to focus on the questions and discussion. And especially since we had a family base, we wanted to make sure that it was people, you know, the participants and their families. When we worked in churches and community centers, often it was larger than that. Sometimes we had groups that were 20 or 25, and then we had more than one promotora that would be there. And as far as working in the homes, I don't think that would work very well in non-Latino populations. But we had, it wasn't very difficult for us to do that. And they actually preferred to be in the home than they did in other places. And they really enjoyed it, where most of the time when we did things in the home, we would schedule it, and they would have the table set very nicely, and they had a placemat for each person, they'd make name tags sometimes, but they really liked having people come and being the host for the event. So it wasn't really, there wasn't too many challenges with it, with our population. I think that there probably would be a lot more challenges for non-Latino groups, though. But
I think in our case, in terms of groups, the home setting was great because, you know, sometimes they took turns hosting. Depending on the dynamic of the group, they would either have food for the session or they would get together even after when we weren't, you know, when we had left. I think that the challenges came with the individual sessions because not every home is the same. And so, you know, what I mean, little things like sometimes smells were really bad or the environment wasn't safe. Or, you know, we had one woman living with 7 men, and so there was sometimes a feeling of insecurity, you know, am I safe? And so there were issues like that. We had 27 groups in each intervention, and so 54 total. Our median group size was 7. So we had a fairly decent group size.
Tara, of your 119 participants who finished, that was individuals, including, like, 5-year-olds who participated?
No, that was all, they were over 18. But anyone who did the research on was over 18, so that wasn't including the kids.
Okay, so that isn't the number of family units, right?
No, that was the participants that were over 18.
How many family groups did you do?
Oh, let's see, I can't remember the exact amount. There was an average between 5 and 10 in each group, so there might have been about 10, 11
okay.
Different groups.
Well, please help me thank our panel.